Callum Smiley, reel 4.
I was saying the Marmon Harrington was a very good vehicle, armoured car, from the point of view of going in the desert, but it was very poor in that its armour was very thin and its gun was fairly useless. And it wasn't until later in the Desert War that we got issued with Daimler armoured cars, and they had thick skin. In fact, I remember being in my Daimler and being attacked by a Stuka and bullets just ricocheting off. They didn't penetrate at all. And it had a reasonable gun, a two-pounder, which would take on enemy transport and things at quite a long range, although it wasn't anything to take on the German tanks with. We weren't supposed to fight tanks with armoured cars anyway, but it was quite a reasonable gun. But against that, poor Daimler, they all broke down. They were very bad goers in the heavy sand, and their transmissions broke one after the other, and by the time sort of Alamein, where we were involved in the sort of push, I think all our Daimlers had already broken down. We were back to the Marmon Harringtons. But by then, we'd captured quite a lot of stuff from the Germans, and we re-equipped our Marmon Harringtons with a better gun, either a 20mm, from Italians and Germans, both had 20mm, which was a much better gun than we had the boys' anti-tank rifle on them, which was quite useless. And then we had 47mm, which were even bigger guns, which we mounted on armour. We took the turret off and mounted them on the chassis, and they were quite good too. So we had a bit something to hit with after a while, but that was only after the sort of battles had been going on. We were very badly mauled at the time of one of Rommel's pushes when he captured Tobruk. We were outside Tobruk, and we went back. And Tobruk was left to look after itself and eventually surrendered. And we went all the way back to Cairo, and that was when we handed in our Marmon Harringtons and went back to Cyprus to become real armoured cars.
Can you tell me some more detail about the way in which you were mauled?
Well, we suffered casualties in our so-called tanks, our dummy tanks. We suffered casualties. We had a great number of them destroyed, because if they were shot up by a fighter with incendiary bullets, which usually in these fighters that some of the bullets were incendiary, the thing would go up in smoke at once and burn. And after burning for about 10 minutes, all the canvas and skirting and three-ply wood would disappear, and there would be a frame on a sort of four wheels, whose tyres were probably blazing as well. I got photographs there. But we had several men killed. But the whole thing was, we were ordered to withdraw. We didn't really know it at the time, but it was a sort of general withdrawal, and everybody was going off backwards at a high rate of knots. And Rommel was advancing equally quickly, and that was when the line wasn't stabilised till we got back to the sort of El Alamein line, by which time we were back in Cairo, and what dummy tanks were left were handed in, and we were put on a ship sent to Cyprus, where we did have armoured cars. We spent a certain amount of time training in Cyprus, which was very interesting, because those of us who'd been trained in armoured cars, having been detached from our dummy tanks to the Royals, we were able in our turn to sort of instruct the people in Cyprus who hadn't been in the Western Desert. We knew we were going to go to the Western Desert. I mean, that was the obvious place we were going to next. And so we were able to train them and brief them on what to expect. And it all worked very well, I think. Cyprus, in fact, we were very busy digging holes in the caves and things, because the Germans had captured Crete. And it was expected that they might try and do an airborne attack on Cyprus. And so we were preparing for that. And the idea was that if they did do an airborne attack, we'd go to ground in all these caves and holes and things we'd dug, and then when the paratroops appeared, we'd pop out and take them armed. Of course, we didn't know at the time that they'd had such severe casualties in Crete. The Germans never used paratroops as such again. In fact, later on, at the time of Alamein, when we were pushing forwards, we captured quite a lot of German paratroops acting as infantry. They were just put in the line as infantrymen. They hadn't parachuted at all. But they fought very well.
And after Cyprus, you went back to North Africa, did you, for Alamein?
We went back from Cyprus. Having been equipped in Cyprus, we then went back to the Western Desert as a whole armoured car regiment, the 1st Household Cavalry Regiment. And we were in both 13 Corps and 30 Corps. We were switched from one to the other. And we held the line from the Qatara Depression in the south. That was the south of the line. The Qatara Depression was a sort of sand sea which was more or less impenetrable by vehicles. And I can't remember how long our line was, but the way the war worked in the desert, you had a screen of armoured cars in front of the infantry, and we were the ones who were in touch with the enemy all the time, and we had wireless sets in our armoured cars, and we were reporting their moves, and occasionally we had a sort of exchange of shots and things with them. But the line was fairly static at that moment, because, I mean, there were vast minefields being laid on both sides. And until Monty had launched his big attack at Alamein, there was nothing really more than what I call patrol activity between, in the sort of no man's land. You advance and they shot at you and you withdrew and you were able to go back and say, well, they're there still, you know, and that was how it sort of worked. You drew their fire and you were able to see where they were. That was what the role of an armoured car was, reconnaissance and keeping in touch with the enemy. I mean, if they had withdrawn, we'd not been shot at, we'd have probably gone on and found they'd disappeared, you know. I mean, it's a very nice way of fighting. I mean, I think of all the sort of units to be in, I think an armoured car unit, certainly in the Western Desert, was the most fascinating and most pleasant. I mean, you had casualties. I mean, we had our fair share. I mean, I remember one day during one of our moves forward, I remember being attacked by our own fighters, mortared by our own infantry, shot at by German Stukas, and shelled by German artillery, all on the same day. But in fact, we had no casualties at all. I mean, but that, you know, being in a sort of no man's land, there was the question of identification, and certainly from the point of view of a pilot flying an airplane at high speed, we were probably nearer to the German lines than we were to our own, so they took us obviously for the enemy. But
was, when you were in the line at El Alamein, was this after Monty had taken over the 8th Army?
Yes, it was. So he came and visited all the troops, including ours. He came and made a sort of pep talk to all of them, one after the other.
What kind of impression did he make?
Oh, very good. I mean, not that we were particularly we were a bit worried. I think some of the generals didn't have our confidence, but on the other hand, we had so many good ones, like Horrocks, or Jorrocks as we called him. He was our corps commander. We thought he was a hell of a good chap, and there were some others in the desert, like Harding and people like that, who we thought were extremely good. There were one or two who we had a bit of our doubts about. In fact, we did have very high hopes of Strafer Gott, who was taking over the whole of the 8th Army. And he came to see us, and we all thought he was a very fine man, but he was killed in an air crash, and that's when Monty came and took over from, because of him. He would have commanded, not Monty, had it not been for the fact he was killed in, I think he was flying in a German airplane, a Fleischer Stork, and it crashed, and he and his crew were killed.
Some people say about Monty that he always appealed over the heads of the officers to the men. Did you find that when he visited you?
I think if I remember rightly, he sort of stood on top of a car, his staff car or something, and said, gather round, and I think everybody gathered round, officers and men. I don't think there was any distinction made between the two. And he certainly sort of came and shook hands with each officer in turn and that sort of thing, and was introduced to them by name. I don't recollect him sort of going above the heads of the officers. He was what I call a bit of a bullshitter, but I think that was part of his act and was very effective, I think. I mean, he had to sort of publicise himself and build up a reputation against Rommel's, whose reputation was extremely high. I mean, we all thought the world of Rommel. We thought he was You know, I mean, if you were opposite Rommel, you expected something to happen. You know, he did have a very, I suppose you might say, a demoralizing effect on British troops in a way, because he deserved it. I mean, he was a bloody good general, let's face it.
Did you find that Montgomery raised the morale of the forces?
I think he did, yes. Well, I think he did, because one of the things he made a point of saying he wasn't going to attack until he'd won. I mean, until he had enough to attack with. We'd been fighting right up to that stage of the war, really. I won't say it's a disadvantage, but I mean, Rommel would not attack until he had, I don't know what it was, a sort of 2-to-1 superiority in tanks and airplanes and goodness knows what. Well, I mean, the first few years of the war, we were short of all these things. We didn't have enough airplanes, we didn't have enough tanks. It wasn't until the Americans came in that really we started seeing in the Western Desert some American general. There weren't American troops there, but we got American tanks called General Grants. And eventually we saw more and more airplanes. I mean, it was quite fun seeing the sort of dogfights. And I mean, first 3 years of the war, 1940-41, I hardly saw any airplanes of our own at all. You know, they were all elsewhere, as it were. But I suppose they were busy in the defence of Britain mainly. But I mean, we didn't see them out in the Middle East until, as I say, the last months of 42, I suppose, just before Alamein. You know, that was when we started to see bombers and fighters on our own side taking on the other side, which is rather comforting, to say the least.
Can you describe the build-up to the offensive at El Alamein?
Well, when you say the build-up, I don't know. I can remember the rehearsals, because we did a big rehearsal for the battle. They laid out, well behind the lines, they laid out the same minefields as they had on our side and on the German side. They'd got aerial photographs, obviously, to work on. And they did a complete rehearsal of the attack the night of Alamein, and we were used as umpires and as enemy. And one or two things went radically wrong, and we reported on various things that had gone wrong. And I'm told later on that exactly the same things happened when they had the actual battle, but I don't know if that's true or not.
What type of things went wrong?
Oh, I think people going the wrong way, and the breakthrough, you know, started with a most tremendous barrage. They didn't have that in the rehearsal, obviously, but they assumed there had been a barrage, and people had to go forward and cut wire and lay tapes so people would know which way to go through the gaps and all that sort of thing. People got hopelessly lost and that sort of thing, you know, map, compass bearings and things weren't read properly and so on, and various units got out of position, strayed from one place to another. You know, there's quite a lot of, confusion of battle, even before the battle started, you know, in a rehearsal. In fact, usually in rehearsal things do go wrong, but rather hopes they will, so on the big day they'll go right, you know. But it was, we didn't see much. You see, being down in our sector of the front, down on the very south, we didn't know what much was going on north of us. When there was any fighting, we did hear bangs and see flashes and things, but I mean, that was all we knew. And rumour was very sort of prevalent, you know, so-and-so's been killed or some regiment's been scuppered or lost so many tanks and equally of victories. I mean, we did very well at some certain stages. And I mean, the Battle of Alam Halfa before the Battle of Alamein, I mean, helped tremendously towards winning Alamein, because we, at that battle, which was really under Horrocks, it was Horrocks' battle, he conceived the whole idea and won it. And we knocked out a tremendous amount of German tanks. I wasn't involved at all, but I mean, we knew it was going on, and I think they had very severe losses at Alam Halfa, which made Alamein that much easier. I mean, there was less tank opposition.
Monty's main offensive at Alamein was right on the opposite end of the line from you, I think.
But yes.
Can you tell me what happened to you personally after the battle was joined?
Well, we were switched. As soon as the battle started, we were pushed north and transferred to Horrocks's 30 Corps, I think he was. And we were told to advance in the south, and we went through, this was a day or two after Al Amein, I suppose, and we pushed through the minefields which had been opened up for us. And I must say, I was pretty impressed the night of Al Amein, because, I mean, the guns opened up and it was the biggest barrage that ever had been fired in history. I mean, every single gun opened up at the same time. It was tremendous. And there were searchlights up at the back. All our searchlights were facing upwards in the sky to make a sort of a false moon, or false daylight, really, make the thing easier. And when we went through these minefields and got to the first positions, there'd obviously been Italians there, but I mean, they were dead everywhere. And I mean, I can remember seeing a man in his trench with his mess tin in front of him. I mean, he was dead, but I mean, the barrage had opened up so suddenly it caught them well and truly unprepared. And then we pushed ahead, and our main job was, well, there were so many prisoners. We had a few sort of little battles with pockets of resistance, mainly German, who eventually surrendered after being sort of shot up from our armoured cars. But the Italians were surrendering in their thousands, and in fact, we just said, march east, I mean, march back to Cairo, and we left the mopping up to be done by people behind us, and we went on, and there were more and more of these people. But then eventually, when the thing came to a grinding halt in our area, we spent about a week going out in patrols, finding pockets of wretched Italians who'd got no transport. Their officers or the Germans had pinched all their transport, and there were groups in hundreds. Some were starving, they had no water and everything. We put them on our armoured cars and ferried them back to our side, as it were. I remember getting at least 16 Italians on my armoured car, hanging on like grim death. They were absolutely delighted the war was over. I mean, they weren't very enthusiastic, to put it bluntly. I don't think the troops who fought in the desert were patch on the ones who fought in Abyssinian places. I mean, they were conscripts. Mussolini had called them up, and I think half those poor devils didn't want to fight at all, you know. They didn't put up much of a resistance. It was the Germans who put up most of the tough resistance that there was. Anyway, we were very disappointed, because we did press on. We didn't get to any particular towns, because we were in the south flank. I mean, all the main towns, like Tobruk and Derna and places, were all in the north. But the fact is that suddenly we were stopped and pulled out of the battle altogether and sent back to Cairo, and then right up to Syria, to the north, right on the Turkish frontier. In fact, what had happened, we didn't realise at the time, that one, we hadn't got enough petrol and supplies to keep the whole of the 8th Army moving forwards, and so they had to sort of stop half and concentrate everything on the push up by the coast, capturing all the places up to Tripoli. And the troops like us were sent actually up that frontier, because there was a scare that the Germans might have invaded Turkey, and if they had done, they would have pushed down through Syria and Palestine and attacked our flank, as it were, or folded it up, really. But anyway, never came off, but we did go up to the Turkish frontier, and that is really the stage at which I left the regiment, because I'd been intriguing with this chap, Billy McLean, when I was in Cairo on one of my leaves. He said he was going to be parachuted into the Balkans, and would I like to join him? And I said I would. I left the regiment up at Raqqa on the Turkish frontier, Syrian frontier with Turkey.
How do you spell that?
Raqqa, Raqqa. And went down to Cairo, where I first of all had to go down to the Suez Canal and do a parachute course, which in those days was run by David Sterling's SAS, because we hadn't got any regular paratroops in the Middle East at that time. The only people who parachuted were the SAS and SOE. So I did a parachute course, and then I went up to Haifa, where they ran a school for agents who were going into the Balkans, a school on the top of Mount Carmel, in fact. And a certain amount of British. Most of the people there were either Greeks or Yugoslavs and Bulgarians, Romanians, all sorts of odds and sods, who were going to be parachuted into their own countries. And in April, having completed all my courses and being thoroughly briefed in Cairo, I went up to Derna and with McLean and a sapper officer and a wireless operator, a team of four, and we were parachuted into the northern Epirus, that's right up in the north of Greece, with the object of walking into Albania, where nobody had yet been from SOE. And so we walked into Albania, we made contact with the resistance, in this case the communists, and we spent the next about 9 months with the communist partisans in Albania, and several teams were dropped onto us, and the SOE network expanded, and eventually a brigadier was sent out, and McLean and I were sent back out of Albania to report to both Cairo and in London. We went back to London, and when we were in London, the brigadier and all his group were captured by the Germans, and we were told to get back again and reorganize, so we had to go back again, parachuted a second time, and this time to the north of Albania, where we'd already seen Anthony Eden in London. He was then the Foreign Secretary. And as we'd started the communists going quite well, he wanted us to go up to the nationalists and royalist right-wing people in the north to get them going. And so we did. But unfortunately, before we could get them going, a civil war had broken out, and the communists, armed mainly by us, were able to overrun the nationalists and royalists. And, of course, they eventually took over the whole country, and they've been what they are today ever since. I mean, Enver Hoxha was a man we worked with and saw a lot of him. And he...
What kind of a man was he?
Hoxha. He was rather a fat slob of a man, I thought, in those days. He had a very flabby handshake anyway. And he had a very violent temper, and I used to argue with him like hell in French. French was a mutual language in Albania with the Albanians. That was their second language in their schools. And I didn't like him or Mehmet Şeyhu, who became the Prime Minister after the war. Mehmet Şeyhu was even more sinister, and they both hated us like mad, but of course they knew that they had to be nice to us to get all the weapons, which we were dropping. You know, I mean, we were having parachute supplies dropping all the time. And it's one of these things about the war. Actually, when we were with the nationalists, the second time we went in, we had Julian Amory with us, who was a politician, and we recommended that more support should be given to the right-wing people, but unfortunately, the left were doing very well in more ways than one. The SOE had been penetrated in the office in Cairo by communists, and in one particular case, a very important signal from Amory, direct to Anthony Eden, who told us to get in touch personally with him if we had anything very important to say. Amory and McLean sent a very important signal to Eden, and it was hijacked and destroyed in the office in Cairo. It never got to Eden at all.
Who do you think was responsible for that?
I know who was responsible, but I can't say because the laws are libel. But there are still people around involved. Don't forget, at that time, Russia was a gallant ally, and they knew there were communists in the SOE in those days, and tolerated them, because, as I say, they were our gallant allies, the Russians, and so... I know pretty well... I know exactly who it did, because the secretary, he made a pass at his female secretary, who didn't like him, and she told us about this when we got back, because she was there when the letter was destroyed. And it might have made a difference. But anyway, in the end, the British were withdrawn from the right-wing people, and all our help was given to Enver Hoxha. And that's how he managed to take over the country, really. It's entirely through us, I'm afraid. But they were fighting the Germans to a certain degree. But I think for every 10 machine guns or whatever you like, we dropped into the partisans. I think they used one against the Germans and kept the other 9 for fighting the opposition in the Civil War.
What degree of popular support do you think the Albanian communists had?
I would say quite a lot in the towns. But very little in the country. The peasants didn't like them, but the townies did, the sort of students. They had the students and people with them. And Enver Hoxha himself had been a schoolmaster, in fact.
Did you like your period in Albania, or was it a trial?
It was a mixture, really. I mean, some of it was great fun. There were moments of intense danger. One was sometimes in pain. One had illnesses and things which you couldn't do much about. It was a mixture of, well, what life in war is like. Moments of boredom, moments of extreme excitement and danger, and sometimes great fun, having sort of barbecues and, you know, sort of parties in the mountains with all the partisans and people. It just depends what was on at the time.
Was it unlike any other country you'd been to, or was it very much like the rest of the Balkans?
Oh, it was very much like Greece in mountains. I mean, physically, it's very much like Greece and Yugoslavia. They're all very similar in appearance. The mountains are the same. They got lovely forests and trees on them.
But from the point of view of the culture of the people?
Oh, no, they're very different. The Albanians speak a different language. I mean, the Greeks speak their language. The Albanians speak completely different, an old ancient Illyrian language, in point of fact. And as I say, we got on in French. I know a few words still. I got a sort of smattering of Albanian when I was there. But we communicated mainly in French. And we did have interpreters. I mean, we had Albanians who spoke. I mean, we recruited them in Albania. We did it. There was an interpreter coming with us on our first operation, and he got cold feet at the last minute, and we had to send him back to put in... He's put in jail, in fact, for the rest of the war, because he was a security risk. He knew what was going on. But we picked up some very good interpreters in Albania, and they were all caught by the communists afterwards, and I think they were shot. Poor devils.
Did the Muslim culture make much of an impact?
Yes. Oh, yes, certainly in the mountains. You see, basically, the south of Albania is Orthodox, and the north is Catholic, Roman Catholic, and the middle is Muslim. Albania roughly was about 1 million people in those days, and you had about 80,000 Catholics in the north, about 120 Orthodox in the south, and the middle sort of 800,000 were Muslims, divided into two. 400 were Sunnis and 400 were Bektashis, of two different Muslim religion. The Bektashis were much more liberal. They sort of allowed to drink and things like that, which the Sunnis didn't. But, I mean, there were mosques all over the place, and in most of the Muslim villages there was the usual call to prayer in the evenings and that sort of thing, until the communists came along. And, of course, the communists wiped out the clergy. But there were some Muslim priests with the communists. I mean, one